Hello, I'm Neil Whelan, and welcome to the Wesleyan Podcast. Depending on when you listen to this, International Men's Day is, or was, on the 19th of November. And to mark the occasion, we've brought together colleagues from across Wesleyan to talk about a variety of issues that impact them as men. Wesleyan prides itself on supporting its colleagues across the group and across the country, and you get a real sense of that here. It's often said that getting men to talk about personal issues is one of the most difficult things in the world. But to be honest, this week, the main issue is getting them to shut up, because this has ended up being one of the longest podcasts we've ever done. But seriously, it's also one of the most interesting we've ever done, covering everything from flexible working with a young family, to infertility support, to prostate cancer. For once, I don't have to give you a compliance warning, we can just go straight into it, so I'll hand you over to Toby, Craig, Gerard, Dan, and first up, AJ.
Hi all, so this podcast is to mark International Men's Day, with this year's theme being zero male suicide, but that's something that we've covered as a business earlier on in the year as a topic in September for World Suicide Prevention Day, with a number of resources available on SharePoint. So we've kind of decided to share some updates around other topics to mark International Men's Day. So just a quick welcome around the virtual table. So I'm AJ Saini. I'm going to be talking about infertility support and kind of what other fertility support is available outside of just male infertility. I've got Dan Gampson, who'll be talking about flexible working and how that's helped him and his young family. Gerard Adams and Craig Smith, who'll be sharing some insights around prostate cancer. And Toby Hester, who'll be sharing some insights around male menopause. So thank you all for being here and sharing your experiences.
Thank you.
I'm sure it'll be very
good to be here.
Very enlightening, to say the least. Right, let's kick off with flexible working.
Brilliant.
Yourself, Dan?
Yeah, thank you, mate. So, yeah, thank you for the intro, AJ. So, as you say, Dan Gampson, I'm the Group Sustainability Manager at Wesleyan. I've been here for just coming up 2 years now. So, yeah, you know, compared to some people who work here, that's a drop in the ocean, isn't it, really? But it feels like I've been here quite a while already, truth be told. But yes, I'm here to talk about flexible working today. So I think flexible working is probably one of the things that I've found personally is awesome about Wesleyan. I think that actually, whether it be as myself to look to go and look after young children or for other reasons, there's a lot of members of staff within Wes who do have flexible working. It's not something that I initially thought I could request or do when I joined Wesleyan. So it was something that I actually discussed with my line manager after being here for about 6 months and the possibility of doing so, because I still think in today's day and age, it's actually quite a rarity for companies to offer flexible working so readily. And to be honest, it was the process of doing it, I think, because it's been so well embedded within Wesleyan, was really easy. I think that, you know, there's maybe some documents that I spoke to HR, had to fill in a one pager just to try and work out the arrangements. There's a conversation that took place with my manager just working out the practicalities of making sure that the work could be condensed, and then no issues whatsoever. We thought we'd give it a go, and I think there was perhaps a 3 month probationary period maybe that we worked out, and then had another review and signed it off, and that's the way it's been ever since. So for the last 18 months I've been working flexibly. There were almost like two options. It was either to get rid of one day completely and then therefore take like a 20% pay cut, or condense hours. So yeah. I wrote a bit of a business card. I went down the condensing hours route, so I work 4 long days now instead. But yeah, you know what, it's invaluable. I think, as I said at the top of this, the rationale behind me working flexibly is because I've got a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old at home. You know, we all know that childcare is so expensive. Yeah, it's like £120 a day for them to go to nursery. Mm-hmm. But actually, regardless of the financial side of things, just that, like, you only have kids like once, really. Like, they're only young, for such a short period of time, that you want to enjoy it, embrace it. And don't get me wrong, like, the amount of people, a little bit tongue in cheek, are like, oh, on Mondays you sit around soft play, chatting to all the yummy mummies, having a coffee. Like, they're hard days, don't get me wrong, like, as any carer.
Harder than a work day.
Yeah, sometimes they're like, when the kids wake up and they're on one, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's such a gift to be able to experience that. You know, again, talk different generations. You know, I love my dad to death, but very much he was like, your mum doesn't work, I'm going to work to pay the bills, this, that, and the other. Yeah. And he'd walk back in at 6:30 and dinner would be on the table. And that was the kind of the mantra back when I was younger. It's such a blessing to have that opportunity. I would thoroughly enjoy it.
Do you need to do the business case or?
Not really.
Just apply?
I think that's for the formal condensed hours, but there are you can have informal, flexible working, which you just arrange with your manager directly.
We spoke it through because there are certain things, and again, you look at your work, your priorities, and whatnot. I don't recall it being a formal document that we did have to fill in.
No, I wonder because I've started, I'm in the process, but I'm only doing it as one day in 10 condensed hours. But I haven't done form yet.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So I've been doing for some few months now.
Mm. So I have formally moved on to condensed working.
Right.
I work 4 long days and 1 short Friday morning. My mother's 89. I'm an only child. Yeah. She's got mobility and health issues. She's quite often going for medical appointments. I can move that half day around the week with my manager's approval. It's absolutely fantastic. As you can imagine, medical appointments are not always straightforward.
No.
They're not just a quick in and out. It's quite often, long periods of time, and I've got that flexibility to take to those appointments myself. Get her out of the car, into the wheelchair, to the appointment. I also, I'm looking after her house now as well as my own. So there's plenty of jobs, organisational things that I need to be doing, and it just really helps having that time that I can spend dedicated to looking after her and making sure that her life is as comfortable as possible with the issues that she's got at the moment. So I found it really, really useful, and I can still get all my work done during the week as well. So
there's almost like an unwritten rule as well. I don't know what your support network at work is like around you as well, but within a team or not, but we kind of have the mantra that as long as you get stuff done,
and
that's where that element of flexibility comes in, because as you say, with parents and children and whatnot, you do have your appointment and whatnot, but even before going to working flexibly, in inverted commas, there was always actually get stuff done mentality. If you have to work an evening, so be it, but and I think that's where trust comes into it quite a lot as well.
Absolutely.
And you break that trust, and it takes a long time to repair it, but I think we're quite fortunate in that regards that we have that up front. So it can be tough by all means, but I would thoroughly recommend if you have parents, young people, just generally life.
got to an age where I want a bit more free time,
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Those golf courses aren't going to play themselves.
Yeah, golf is not my thing, but
So if we've got somebody listening in right now who's thinking, I'd like to do this, we're not quite sure what to do next, what would you recommend they do?
I think probably the first point in time is to speak to your line manager, to be fair, Toby. Again, I don't know, it all depends on team dynamics, what's going on and whatnot, but Wesleyan as a company are supportive. So I think having that conversation with your line manager in a one-to-one. And then from there, as I say, the process is really simple. So HR, it's a one-page document to fill out, and then it's under review.
I think there's some pretty good information on the intranet as well.
Yeah.
I think that's where I started before I spoke to
people on the policies page.
But she's got quite a few people in the team. That's the other thing. As more people do it and you become aware, it becomes a lot easier because you've got no people you can ask.
Exactly.
You need someone to be the trailblazer who starts it. And it kind of rolls forward. Like I said, it's like blokes don't necessarily take that for daycare or looking after kids, but I know you do it, and I know there's a couple of others, and there's one of the other team in the risk.
Yeah,
I think actually it's needs a couple of people to kind of do it, and opens the door for others.
And then it just kind of becomes the norm as well, doesn't it? And to be fair, without segueing in too much, you're really blessed to be able to have kids and want to spend time with them and experience that, and then it kind of leads on nicely to your experiences, to be fair, AJ, because you take for granted these things, but actually if you and your partner try for a long time to have children, the last thing you want to do is go straight back to work again, isn't it? So I don't know if that's probably quite a good segue, but having your experience, do you do flexible as well? Or?
No, so I don't do flexible, but that's my son, he's just gone back into work from post maternity, so It might be something later on down the line I'd consider, but probably not, because the little one's happy in nursery and we've got wraparound childcare that that others don't necessarily have, like a family and so on, to support. But yeah, it's a nice little segue into the second topic, the joys of infertility and what the support mechanisms are. So I, just to kind of almost share my own personal journey, I've done some stuff previously with Wesleyan for International Men's Day last year, I think, as well, just around kind of the challenges of infertility. I mean, my own personal journey, it was pre-Wesleyan when I found out that potentially I couldn't have kids. That was, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, which, as you can imagine, is a challenging time, and you kind of just think, that's the end of the road, isn't it? You know, straight away. But from a kind of support mechanism, I kind of work with, now I work with some external charities, but the support mechanism isn't there for men, especially looking at infertility. I think there is a bit more support for women, but the reality of the matter is it's not there in the way it should be. Now, Wesleyan as a business have kind of stepped up on kind of providing specific leave for infertility support, whether it's male, female, or whether you're going through IVF cycles and so on. But I found my experience quite traumatic, I think it probably is how I'd say it, because whilst I have the support of my manager, it's like, it's the topic that no one wants to talk about. It's like, oh yeah, we'll give you the time off, but they don't want to talk about the topic at all. It's just like, do what you need to do. And, fine, just do what you need to do for appointments, and that's it. There's no let's talk about it, or let's talk about how you're feeling, or how's the impact on your mental health, etc. It's just very much,
So, AJ, who did you go to for your emotional support?
I bottled it up, to be honest. And then luckily for me, my wife's quite supportive. Yes. And so once I'd opened it up to her, it was like, actually, it wasn't so bad personally for me, because my in-laws had a long journey to have my wife. It took them 9 years almost before they had her. So we kind of knew that was the basis for even getting tested, was for both of us. It was my wife to get tested, and then mine was like, oh, there you go, go and get tested just in case. And mine popped out as zero sperm, as it were. Yeah. I think because we had that support network from family who understood it a little bit more, that was our kind of basis. But I think post having kids now, and I'll kind of come touch on that in a second, but now I know what his support is available, and that would have been massively helpful back then, probably, just to kind of know where to go, what to do. And I didn't have any awareness of that, to be honest.
Well, kind of naively, from my point of view, like, is it, how do you start on that journey? Is it something that NHS covers, or like, do you go to a GP, or is it all specialist?
It was GP initially for the testing, but then, unfortunately for us, we went through NHS for kind of, you go to an IVF clinic, effectively, fertility clinic, through the NHS. But because I have a genetic condition from birth, they were like, well, we can't do any of yours anyway. So it was like, well, until we know about that genetic condition, then we can't do anything on the NHS. Then you've got to meet all the criteria. You need to lose some weight. You need to control this element, because I've got high blood pressure from my genetic condition. You've got to control that. You've got to control this. And it's like, actually, we're going to be spending 2, 3, 4 years on the NHS before I can even have testing and proper testing and treatment. That was the challenge we found. Frustratingly on the NHS, it was like, oh, here's my card. I also work for a private clinic. And then it was like, well, we can get you in next week. It was literally that simple. And within, I think, 4 or 5 weeks, I was operated on. Like, literally from first appointment to being operated on to actually test for potential sperm, which obviously, given I have two kids now, successful. But, it was literally that quick. And it was like, okay, you pay the price for it, but you look at 3 years versus 3 months. From... I think it's like 9 month wait times between appointments.
Wow.
Just between getting one appointment to the next, because it's a postcode lottery for IVF at the moment. Whereas privately, we went from first appointment to my wife being pregnant in 7.5 months, eight months.
I bet that was not a shock, but I think you must have mentally thought or prepared yourself thinking, this is going to be a really long journey. And then for it to happen so quickly.
Sperm, it was like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
You're good to go through the rest of the process. But even then, even the NHS supports, and my wife had to go through some pre-procedure, and it's like that. Do that on the NHS because there's no point paying us X amount for it, because it's just a simple procedure, and even that was messed up at the last minute. So it's like, you know, that's where the NHS is struggling. But fertility support itself is just, it's just not there for male or female, but for male, it's non-existent, really, to be honest.
You know that point you're making about management and what they do.
Yeah.
Have you got any sort of thoughts about how that could be done better? Because I guess as a manager, I there are times when I'll think if somebody really doesn't want to talk about something, then I'll let it go. And actually, maybe that might not be the right thing to do. But how do you judge?
I think the key there is knowing probably know people in the business who can then support managers. Because ultimately, like, if you said to me, oh, I don't know how to handle this situation, or I'm not sure how to approach that situation, I can kind of give some guidance, or I'll be like, actually, let them come and talk to me directly if that helps the process. And I think until we know, okay, there's X, Y, Z people in the business that have either experienced it or have had some training or experience through it, that's the only way. It's, you know, I think that's the only way we can kind of approach it.
It's not dissimilar to kind of prostate cancer in the terms of it's a kind of taboo subject.
Yeah.
It's intensely personal.
Yeah.
And many people may want to remain private about it. So is that kind of balance of how much do you support, offer a listening ear to someone who may or may not want to share.
Yeah, and I'm quite, let's say, open about it. I mean, we've spoken about it today, you know, that I would never have thought about even talking about, you know, literally going into an operating theatre and having somebody slice my, for want of expression, bollocks open, and, you know, just to test for that. But it's quite an invasive thing.
Yeah.
And you need to have the support mechanism around to just either give them their space or then point them in the right direction of resources, because that's the only way we can really progress it forward, to be honest. Which kind of leads me on to kind of some of the work I do with Fertility Network UK, and they have a branch that's called HIM Fertility, which is focusing specifically on male infertility. So they kind of do a lot of work on supporting men in, you know, International Men's Day as an example. There's an event in London specifically talking around male infertility, which is being run by Infertility, and I'm trying to just bring the subject to workplaces. So my kind of role as an ambassador for Fertility Network UK is how can we broach the conversation more and more in the workplace. So I'm kind of, that's my focus area, is what do we do to improve workplace fertility, because we've seen it with Wesley, and when I came here and when we went through our, what was effectively our second round of IVF, there was no fertility policy. It was very much manager's discretion. Now we've gone to a bit more of a defined process. We've got, you know, dedicated 5 days off for potentially per IVF cycle. But actually the flip side is managers have to have that ability to say, actually, it's not about an IVF cycle. It's, oh, you've got fertility issue. How do we address it? Use that time for addressing that specifically, because it's quite a draining process. As it were.
Was that the kind of the Kickstarter for enhanced maternity, paternity? Like, do you feel like actually with the changes in policies?
Yeah, I think that whole employee value proposition has encompassed all of that, because actually we needed to improve as a business, and we have taken really positive steps in that regard. I mean, I kind of worked with kind of HR, so look, these are every single bit of time. This is every single bit of time off, but it's the kind of thing that you think, oh, going for an appointment, but actually it's a 1 hour trip either way, and it's an IVF appointment, so you get the call, you know, the night before to say you've got to come in at 7 a.m. and sometimes it is literally as simple as that with the IVF stuff. My wife was, I think, every day for the last 5 days of the cycle she had to go for morning appointments at 7 a.m. so it's like you've got to build all that in. But flexible working works alongside that as well, because there's so many. I mean, like, I was looking at stats the other day, and I was like, when you look at how much of a problem it is, I mean, from an ethnicity point of view as well, I mean, just down to the fact that you've got a 1/3 better chance if you're white compared to black of even being successful with IVF. There's the financial impact on their mental health. I mean, the recent study done by Fertility UK, they pointed out that 93% of people going through either infertility support or through IVF, etc., are struggling financially, to having an impact on their finances, just being able to manage it, which is, it's a staggering number.
Yeah,
you know, so
what's the cause of that sorry, this is me being really ignorant now, but that point about being more likely to be successful if you're white than black, is that a biological thing?
Biologically and genetic makeup, etc. I mean, it's weird because actually you look at, I think they said 14% of IVF patients are Asian, but that they only represent 7% of the population. So there is that, there's other links, there's disparities that are there, and kind of that's where the challenge is. But I mean, even from a male infertility perspective, 50% of fertility issues are because of a male fertility issue. And that's staggering. When you think of the levels of support are so different between male and female, that's where the problem is. Because blokes tend to bottle it up at the best of times. Because it's always that thing, oh, you shoot your blanks then. That might be what it is, but the impact of that is just...
Is that kind of like that classic like pub conversation, isn't it, after a few beers where flippant things be said, and there's obviously there's the mental health. You said you bottled it up, but you know, as a mental health first aider as well, like they're difficult conversations to have, aren't they? And to build a rapport with someone to feel comfortable enough to have it when you've not got a pint of Guinness in front of your tea maker.
Absolutely, you need to go all the way back down to even education level. So there's one of the studies they did was university freshers, and 48% of freshers had never had any education about fertility treatments. There's like there's just core lack of understanding, and once you get to a certain point, you're just never going to think about it unless you have that problem.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's one of those. You know, it's a hard one to bear, but the support and resources from for charities are. Getting better, but there's still a long way to go, as it were. So obviously we talked about kind of taboo subjects, and I think one of the other elements is male menopause, because it's something I had no idea about, really.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I've been a little bit of a journey with this subject, which I'm going to try and take you through in a few minutes now. But when I started out, you know, we were talking about ideas for this podcast. The idea for this section was sort of to talk a bit about male menopause, or it's called andropause sometimes, because andro means man, which given menopause starts with men already, is very confusing. So the whole menopause was already taken. So all very confusing. But, you know, it was to say, right, okay, here's an issue, here's how it might affect men, and here's what's going on with it. When I went and did some research, it didn't turn out to be quite what I was expecting. So little bit of suspense. But we started off because I'm on the Gender Network, and under that Gender Network, we've obviously done a lot of work on menopause and the effect that has on women over time. And part of what we did on that was we looked at some of the information that we had on our sort of learning and development we learn for menopause, and there was a course on there, and I'd had a look at it, and there was a bit at the bottom that talked about male menopause and how menopause might affect men. So I was kind of conscious of this and thinking, oh, there might be a sort of relevance to International Men's Day. So I went away and did a little bit of research on this and found out that actually the male menopause is not considered by most medics to be a real thing. So that's I'm now talking about something that might actually not be real. So let's just explore that slightly more. So obviously both men and women, actually, but men a lot more so, have testosterone in their body, which is a hormone. It's the hormone that regulates a lot of sort of male sexual function and things like that. But testosterone starts to reduce in the body over the period. And typically what happens is that it reduces just by a little bit every year from when you're aged about 30 to about 40. But actually the latest research on this is that it's only reducing by about 1% each year for most people who are having sort of a common experience. Now, there are people who don't have testosterone made in their body, you know, from birth, and that obviously causes some issues. And there are also examples where testosterone stops being made by the body. It's actually made partly out of cholesterol, I learned from when I was looking at research, I did not know. and that's called by the brilliant name of hypogonadism, which I assume that somebody had made up, but apparently it's a real word. So there we go. But that's very uncommon medical device, and probably, you know, I mean, obviously if you have got that, then that's not going to be great, but probably isn't going to be a common experience.
Want me to ask whether testosterone is produced anymore?
Yes, yeah, exactly, absolutely. I think there's some debate, actually, as to whether having low testosterone can lead to issues with obesity because, or, you know, heart disease because of cholesterol, but research needs to be contested either way, so
okay.
not quite sure there's any evidence one way or the other yet on that as to whether taking testosterone might help with your health. But yeah, so what I guess what I learned is that, so looked on the NHS website, and they say that male menopause, andropause as an idea is actually a bit misleading and not necessarily terribly helpful, because whereas with menopause there is obviously an event that happens in women's lives where they stop menstruating, and that obviously does have an observable effect, typically there isn't an equivalent within the way that male hormones change over time. It's just happening naturally. Now there are things which lower testosterone can cause, things like more fat being secreted into your body, you having lower energy, lower sex drive, potentially quite a lot of mental, you know, symptoms as well, like depression, sometimes insomnia, and so forth. But actually, most of the research now says that these are probably as likely to be about lifestyle issues as they are to be about a particular period of your life and your testosterone getting lower. So it might be all kind of caught up in that, but the sort of things that you'd expect your doctor potentially to say anyway as a result of those symptoms. So are you getting enough sleep? Is your diet appropriate? Or some of the things that you were saying, the NHS was saying to you, AJ. Are you doing enough exercise? I'm ticking off this list thinking all of these things apply to me, unfortunately. Are you drinking too much alcohol? Are you smoking? All of these things. So typically where you've got those symptoms, even though they may potentially make you think, oh, perhaps this is a testosterone thing, perhaps this is a, you know, male menopause type thing, probably in most cases actually isn't that simple, and you should be looking a bit more about your lifestyle stuff. Now there's a lot of stuff on the NHS website that talks about you know, the issues that men often have with mental health in middle age, and this is a point that I think I actually did a talk on at last International Men's Day, a little bit about, you know, the number of people who are bottling it up, as we're talking about asking for help or not. You know, and the extent to which people have really difficult issues with that, particularly probably for age 40 and beyond, and the extent to which suicide is a real genuine risk at that age and above as well. It's a really common cause of death, really, sadly, amongst men, much more elevated in men than women. So I suppose I thought I was finding out about a sort of medical condition and hormones, but I think probably I've sort of led me back to the same place, really, which is there is a very small chance you might have a very unusual condition, but more likely, if you are seeing issues of that kind of type, it's probably a lifestyle thing to have a think about, and also at the same time, you know, obviously do talk to people. So didn't end up quite where I expected to when I did the research, but there we are. That's the beauty.
Sounds like quite a journey you've been on there.
It was very it's been emotional.
you touched on a very real point, which is you get to we otherwise called the midlife crisis.
Yeah.
And for men, that's a really big issue, and it's we don't talk about that very much. You know, I'm at the other side of midlife, which is great because I've been through all that, and it's horrible. When you have bad times in the middle of your life, it's not something that we deal with very well, and we're getting so much better at. But maybe that's something we should try to really look at. How do we help people who are in those mid years where their children are getting a bit older or are leaving home, and they're getting to that point where they're recognising the changes in their age and their position in life, you know, which then leads on to the depressions and all the rest of it, and can lead to much more serious issues.
I think that's right. And I think, I mean, as somebody who's just past 40 this year and is sort of feeling a bit midlifey, I think it can feel, it's a classic male thing, but it feels as if it could be a bit self-indulgent. It's a bit like, oh, pull yourself together. It's not, you know, it's midlife crisis, whatever. Are you going to go buy a car? Are you going to, yeah, that's it. So again, it's just like saying, no, that's a feeling I'm actually having. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And often talking.
Talk to people about it, yeah.
And that's, I suppose, the symptom of remote working and post-COVID as well. It's like that enhances the problem, because people are just cooped up at home. If you're not in a Teams calls all day, you're doing something that's not constantly on calls with people or whatever, then actually you don't get to see people that often. And that's the other side of the coin, isn't it?
It is. It
makes that problem a lot worse.
And we are getting much better at talking to each other, but I really would stress that, you know, if you're having problems of understanding your purpose in life and got to that kind of age where, you know, was the motorbike enough? which is very midlife.
Is that what you did?
No. I'm push bikes. I only had 11, but I had to downsize.
It's a go faster stripe for something. Away you went.
Literally, thank you, Toby. Yes, one is my pimp bike. It's red, metallic red and gold. And yes, I pimped that up. And yes, indeed. But yeah, so that's mine. But I've had, that's my 30-year main hobby. But talking to people is so important, because no matter where it takes you to, opening up on most issues that we talk about is just so enriching and helps you move your journey.
It's because you suddenly realize how many people are being affected by it as well. That's the thing. You think you're affected by something in silo, and you suddenly start talking to people, suddenly realize, oh, actually.
It's particularly true for depression. I mean, nobody else who's suffered depression, but when you've had one, it's a very different world. If you don't reach, until you reach, for me anyway, until I reached out to somebody and spoke to somebody, I couldn't get out of that rut.
Mm-hmm. You know? And it's only when you do talk to people you appreciate how many, as exactly how you say, I've got a fairly tight group of friends, but at the moment, yeah, a few of them have had it going through breakdowns, crises for whatever reason. Yeah, it's tough. And it's, as you say, but like I said, AJ, like for every problem, you're not in silo, aren't you? So there's always going to be people sharing.
And it's absolutely true, isn't it? Problem shared is a problem halved.
Mm.
You start to work through things so much better when you've had a chat with someone. Just that one word of comfort and kindness from someone can be all the difference.
And so, I mean, I guess we've led on to some quite serious subjects there, and perhaps our conclusion on male menopause is a little bit uncertain one way or the other. But I think in the last section we're going to talk about something which absolutely is a real medical issue and is very clear for I was going to say for better or worse, but mostly for worse.
it's a great reality, yes. It was a reality anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking prostate cancer, obviously,
yeah.
AJ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll let you share your experiences.
Well, I'll start by saying I think it's quite ironic that, you know, I joined the wellness group in all the employee committees, and the one thing I took on was trying to advocate people getting screened for prostate cancer, because there's no national screening program. It's one of the biggest killers. It kills 12,000 men a year in the UK. Very common. One in eight of us will experience a problem with prostate cancer, I'll say, because all of us, if we live long enough, will have it, but not care about it. You get much beyond 70, and it's such a slow-moving target, it will probably be something they go, yeah, don't worry about it. But for a lot of us, we have to be concerned. And so I took that on, and I sorted out some screening for us. Because
I was on with that first screening as well.
Yeah, so I've done a couple of screenings
five years ago.
Yeah. Which, as we'd spoke earlier, Craig was saying that, you know, his test was completely off the chart at the low, so didn't have to worry about it then. And for me, that's the same. It's just because I had a friend who had prostate cancer diagnosed very early that I decided that this was something that needed to be really promoted. But that's the irony, is that now I've been diagnosed this year and been through the whole journey this year, from having an adverse PSA. Mine was 7, which isn't particularly high, and it was false because the follow-up was 2, which is fine for a man of my age, but they found something with my prostate, And the prostate is a funny little thing. It's tucked right up in your pelvis. It's part of your sex organs. It produces the seminal, not the semen, but the fluid that the semen goes into and the fluid to make the semen liquid so it all can go out. And sits right under the bladder. So prostate cancer is symptomless. I've got no symptoms, none at all, until it gets really advanced. Generally, expanded prostate causes symptoms. As my sister delightfully puts it, if you can't pee on a sixpence, you probably don't know what a sixpence is, but if you can't pee on a sixpence, there's probably something going on with your prostate.
Debit card.
Yeah.
So it's all the different generations,
eh? So that's, yeah. So it expands, it causes urinary problems because it sits right under the bladder. But yeah, my personal journey was from that was get an MRI. MRI showed something, get a biopsy. And I went privately and been through a whole bunch of stuff, but the biopsy shows and confirms that I've got a cancer that's sufficiently aggressive that I need to do something about it. And I would just recommend anybody 45 or over, particularly if you're from a African Caribbean background, because unfortunately for you, it's one in four, get tested every year. PSA isn't entirely reliable, the PSA test, so you have a personal score. So it might be nothing, you might get slightly high and it'd be nothing, and it might be something, but you'll be able to tell if something's changing. If it's changing, that's the important things to do. I know that for Craig...
So it's 5 years since I had my first PSA and test, and it was my score was below one, which was fine. It got to 5 years, and I thought, perhaps it's time I had another test, and my score this time was 12, so I've been referred to... urology department at New Cross in Wolverhampton. I'm quite early on in this journey, so I've been through the MRI scan and I'm waiting for the date for the biopsy, which I'm hoping is going to be next week or possibly the week after. And then I should have something concrete. So it's the start of a journey. I'm trying to be quite pragmatic about it. It's something that happens to a lot of men. We've all got a prostate. As you get older, things go wrong with them. Yeah. So the thing that I'm really glad about is that I had the test and I'm now in the system. So presumably if they find something, I'll receive some sort of treatment. But if there isn't anything and I've just got an abnormally high score, at least then they will be monitoring me going forward. And that's some consolation as well. So it's still quite early days for me, but I've got to that age as well where I've got two friends that have got prostate issues. One's actually got a catheter in at the moment, which is quite a scary prospect. But it's something we need to talk about. It's something it's a test that we all need to do, and it's something we need to be more open about as a society as well, because as Gerald says, it does kill so many men each year, and it's actually preventable with the right testing and the right treatment.
Yeah. I mean, it's dispelling the myth as well, because like the assumption is your first examination. There's a mental picture that comes with it, and it's like, no, it's a blood test.
Yeah, is it a blood test or a urine sample?
It's a blood test. Yeah.
And even when it gets to the, right, we need to have a proper feel.
Yeah.
Or DRE. DRE is, they conveniently call it, a digital rectal examination. It's not that big a deal.
If you're the doctor for that, does that make you Dr. Dre?
Very good. Yeah. I mean, that's not a big deal. And the MRI does.
I haven't been through that.
No.
Examination yet. They put me straight into the MRI, which I'm not sure if that's...
Which is far more accurate, the MRI. And looks inside the prostate itself to see if there's anything in there that's adverse. So it doesn't hurt in any way, any of that stuff. And it's not particularly, it isn't invasive. The consequences are different. But that's something that most of us won't have to address, even though the percentage of people who have got prostate cancer as you get older gets pretty high. To people over 70, most of them have got a prostate cancer in them that they're unaware of and don't need to be aware of.
Yeah.
You know, it's if it's an abnormal set of cells that is such that it's going to grow and cause you a problem. that you have to go and go for the treatment. Treatment is quite radical. And one of the things that was interesting was you talk about the length of time in the NHS. For treatment, it's the opposite with cancer. Cancer in the NHS has got a massive focus. They're targeted on it. They are trying to get every step of the way within 2 weeks, every step within 2 weeks. Prostate cancer does not move that quickly. So I have been through two very separate conversations, the NHS consultants and their treatments and the private. The first private guy I go to sees all the stuff that they've done. By the time I've had the MRIs, you can see I've got something definitely there. He says, Mr. Adams, he says, we could be having exactly the same conversation in a year's time. It would be no different. This does not move that quickly. Okay? So you have to be careful that you consider what you're being told if you end up in that journey.
Yeah.
And I would strongly recommend, if you can afford it, if you're fortunate like me to have it through work, go and see a private consultant and get a second opinion. Because the other thing that you get access to is, currently in the NHS, they will only offer you two different treatments. They're both radical. They both sound unpleasant because they are. One is radical radiotherapy, not normally offered to you until you're in your late 60s, 70s. Radical prostatectomy, just have the whole thing out. There are other treatments, lots of them. Not really something we should talk about. Each one be here forever, but it's worth doing because they're different. And if you've seen in the news recently, one of those ones, which is a much more directed radiotherapy beam, which is appropriate to people, isn't looking to be put now into the NHS set of treatments.
Okay.
So that reflects very strongly on mine. I went to see the NHS consultant and they said, well, on balance, we're on the cusp of saying active surveillance locally. The set of consultants said, yeah, active surveillance. The regional said, no, treatment. And then they give me the one treatment they've got available. Said, yes, have a second opinion. Go and see the privates. And they go, private consultants saying, well, hang on. One, it is safe for you to do active surveillance. And two, that's quite a radical treatment. You could have these various ones, which are much less invasive, much less impactful, and far less risk of having the serious side effects on your life. Because they talk about lifestyle issues, and I wanted to really say this, is that they're talking about incontinence, more likely to be urinary incontinence. Most of them are likely to be long-term post-operative effect, but not permanent. Bowel incontinence, less likely. Depending if radiotherapy, and depending on how the radiotherapy is done, is more likely of that. And erectile dysfunction is a big issue with prostate. If you have to have your prostate removed, they've got to go round all of the nerves that come down, go round the prostate, that are the nerves that deal with erections. So you are, they say, oh, well, it's much better because we use these robots and things. And then you read the percentages of people who end up with erectile dysfunction. You go, 55% doesn't sound like low.
Yeah.
So it has profound impacts when you have to have the treatment, but it's better than death.
Oh, yeah.
So it's been a journey, and I have to say, I hope Craig doesn't have to have that conversation where you sit with the consultant who says, yes, Mr. Ramsden, sorry, it is cancer. Because no matter what you think about preparing for that, it's a very different
thing. And it's fair to say, actually, there's a whole load of reasons why you might have a elevated PSA score, and that's why they do the MRI scan and then the biopsy. So there could be prostate inflammation, bladder conditions, all sorts of things that can be triggering that outcome. So it isn't always prostate cancer, but it is the primary concern.
But they can treat it,
yeah,
and they can cure it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. It's the most curable cancer. Very, very slow moving, caught early, so it's localized, they're going to cure it.
Yeah.
You know, and any of the other things they can cure. You know, it's some of the treatments are less pleasant, but they can cure. And particularly for African Caribbean, get tested from the age of 45, get tested, have the little blood test once a year. It's no big deal. 5 minutes of a blood test.
Yeah.
And it could save your life.
Is 45 almost that tipping point then, Gerald? Is that what they recommend?
As you get older, it's more likely, yeah. I mean, they would say, if you're not African Caribbean, they'd say 50.
Mm.
But, I mean, if we have to have it done privately if you've got no other indicators of that kind of age, and there's a charity called the Graham Fulford Charitable Trust that run events all across the country, easy accessible round here. It's 20 quid.
Yeah.
You know, so they ask for a £20 donation once a year. And if that's going to save your life, it's absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
You know? It's that concept that people think, private trip or private test, how much it's going to cost. And actually, when you say it's 20 quid, it's like, it's nothing, is it, really, in the grand scheme of things?
No. And I'm sure if you contact them because you thought it was too much, you can't afford it, they would say, we're a charity, we'll do it for you. It's fine. Yeah, so.
But you should be able to get it through your GP as well.
You can, yeah. Once you get beyond 55, if there's any kind of indications, they'll do one anyway. Yeah. I'm having one every 3 months now under the active surveillance via my GP. Mm. You know, it's hilarious because you ring them up for the results and they say, oh, that's normal. And you go, I need to know the score. I need that number. Yeah. I've got to give this to my consultant so he can tell me what he thinks of it. You know? Yeah.
But no, thank you very much, all of you, for kind of sharing your own experiences and kind of, hopefully this is useful. And I think the key takeaway here is there's a lot of resources that Wesleyan provide and a lot of information, kind of Viva Engage, Employee Assistance Programme, SharePoint, in terms of News Hub and the kind of events that we run through there. Have a look through, if you go on Wes People and go through to policies, there's policy links for flexible working, fertility. There's the networks themselves.
So yeah, contact me if you want to know anything about prostate cancer.
Well, this is the thing, and I think that's the key takeaways. If you don't feel comfortable talking to your manager about something, come to one of the networks or come to the EAP, etc. And if we can't answer the question, and we're not experts in the subject, but if we can't answer it, then we will look to try and find you the answers or point you in the right direction or the right support as much as is possible.
Definitely. I think just rounding up, just for the very, very first point you made, AJ, as well, is about suicide prevention as well being the main driver this year. So it's just worth mentioning Wesleyan's mental health first aiders again, because there's quite a few of us. And again, just an impartial ear always. Absolutely. So there's plenty of people, and we're very fortunate that there's some people to talk to.
Thank you all.
Cheers, chaps.
Phenomenal. Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you to AJ, Dan, Gerard, Craig and Toby. If after listening to that you think Wesleyan sounds like a nice place to work, you can find all the latest vacancies at careers.wesleyan.co.uk. You can also learn more about us on the main website, wesleyan.co.uk, and across social media on Twitter X, Facebook, Instagram and of course LinkedIn. And if you've liked what you've heard here, you can like and subscribe to us on all the usual podcast platforms, as well as find us on YouTube, where there's a whole library of videos covering a wide range of topics. But that's it for now. So until next time, thanks for listening.